Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer-Range Future, titled Biology and Climate Change. Our speaker is Professor Thomas Lovejoy, Senior Fellow at the United Nations Foundation. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Pardee Center Director, Professor Anthony Genetos.
I hesitate to tell you how long I've known Tom. My first extended conversation with Tom was actually in Brazil, just prior to the Rio conference, where we had an extended conversation fueled by Caipirinhas on the use of remote sensing to detect and measure tropical deforestation. The reason that that has stuck with me all those years is that Tom has been, was then and is still is, one of the leading scholars of the challenges of understanding patterns of biological diversity and understanding the stresses that we are putting on it. At the same time, he's had an astonishing influence on a whole raft of issues related to public policy, related to biological diversity and conservation, ranging from the first estimates of widespread extinction that were part of a report that he authored for PCAST in, I think, the year 2000, advice to the president, to the project that he is probably the best known for, the Forest Fragments Project in Brazil, which we learned earlier today is close to finishing its fourth decade of field research. A significant empirical demonstration of what it means to apply theoretical notions of island biogeography to a tropical landscape and to appreciate the time scale over which these important ecological and biological changes actually occur as we manipulate the landscape. Tom has also been instrumental in such ideas as the Debt Swap for Nature, a policy program that allowed developing countries who owed debt that they could only repay in their own currency to use that to establish wildlife preserves and conservation land, something that's had an idea that's had a truly global impact on the preservation of wild land in developing countries. So I can't tell you enough about Tom, so I'm going to stop and let Tom speak for himself. I know you're going to learn a lot from this presentation, and I think we'll all enjoy the question and answer period afterwards. So with no further ado, Tom, let me give you the podium, and we'll start.
Great. Thank you. So thank you, Tony. Thank you, Pardee Center. Thank you, Boston University, for the opportunity to come and give an overview of the subject of biology and climate change, two topics which are deeply intertwined. So climate change fits into what Stockholm Resilience Center, Johan Rockström, and others have described as planetary boundaries. And they're basically conditions that are being exceeded. They're the conditions which nurtured the rise of human civilization. Whether you like the idea of it as a boundary or not, they clearly delimit the conditions which nurtured the rise of human civilization. And this was the diagram from the very first paper on that subject. And as you'll see, the nitrogen cycle is quite distorted. Climate change is, I think, underestimated in its degree of distortion in this diagram, and I think Johan Rockström now agrees. And biodiversity loss is by far the greatest. And the reason for that is very simple, because nothing is called an environmental problem unless it affects living systems. So biodiversity actually integrates all environmental problems. The one we'll focus on today, of course, is climate change. When Arrhenius wrote his famous paper in 1896, what he was really trying to answer was the question, why is the Earth a habitable temperature for humans and other forms of life? Why isn't it too cold? And the answer, of course, was greenhouse gases and the greenhouse effect. And he actually calculated with pencil and paper what doubling pre-industrial levels of CO2 would do to the average temperature of the Earth, and got it exactly where the big, fancy supercomputer models project it today. He did not, of course, have a lot of detail, nor did he really understand much about the previous history of the climate and previous tens and hundreds of thousands of years, and in particular, that last 10,000 years of unusual climatic stability in the upper right, which includes all recorded human history. It includes a significant portion of unrecorded human history, the origins of agriculture, the origin of human settlements. Basically, the point is that the entire human enterprise depends on a stable climate. And during that same 10,000 years, of course, all ecosystems were adjusting to a stable climate. And that, of course, we're changing. And we're already seeing signals from nature, have been for some time now. Some of that is around the solid and liquid phases of water, and prominent amongst that, of course, is the decline in both the thickness and the extent of sea ice in the Arctic Ocean. And we're seeing in the Northern Hemisphere lakes freezing up later in the year, the ice breaking up earlier in the spring. And about everywhere one looks at glaciers are in retreat. And so here we have Glacier National Park about to become that only in name. And in the tropics, where there are glaciers on high mountains like Mount Kilimanjaro or Mount Kinabalu, all tropical glaciers are retreating at a rate that they will be gone within 15 years, creating serious problems for cities like La Paz, which depend on glaciers for their water supply. Other physical elements we're seeing is the increase of sea level, originally because of the thermal expansion of water, to which is now added the melting of ice on land, such as in Greenland, and way beyond the points in this particular graph here. And so on the eastern shore of Maryland, the Blackwater National Wildlife Refuge, due to a combination of natural subsidence of the land as well as increase in sea level, is well on its way to becoming a marine refuge. And of course, there now is increasing probability that we're seeing more frequency of intense weather events, including tropical cyclones. In addition, we are seeing increased wildfire in the American West. We see that on the television screen. We see it in the newspapers every year. There's absolutely no question about it. It's statistically robust. It's warmer summers and earlier snow melts, less snow in winter, this winter being a notable exception. So the rest of what I want to talk about is biology. So Lilacs have been noted to be blooming earlier in New England. At the Royal Botanic Garden in Kew, a whole series of plant species have been recorded as blooming earlier. Richard Premack, with us this evening, is one of the people who's been doing extraordinary work documenting this change in timing. And it's not just plants that are changing their cycles. Animals are changing their cycles. So in the U.S., tree swallows are nesting earlier, migrating earlier, nesting earlier, laying eggs earlier. And as Richard was telling me at lunch today, there are a whole series of things that now extend later into the autumn, sort of complementing all these events which are occurring earlier in the spring. More important, I think, we're already seeing species beginning to change where they actually occur geographically. So this butterfly, the Edis checkerspot, is one of the two best-known butterfly species in North America, the other obviously being the monarch. And it has clearly been moving northward in latitude and upward in altitude in search of its desired climatic conditions. And Joshua trees are now growing outside of Joshua Tree National Park. And the National Arbor Day Foundation, which one can hardly categorize as some wild-eyed environmental terrorist organization, but really is just about people who love to plant trees, literally found it necessary to produce a new hardiness zone map to guide their members as to which species they could be successful with, depending on where they live. And we're seeing similar changes occurring in the oceans. So plankton distributions are changing, fish distributions are changing, lobsters are moving northward in New England. And interestingly enough, these kinds of changes seem to be happening more rapidly in the marine environment than they are on the land. In the Chesapeake Bay, the great estuary of eastern North America, the eelgrass communities turn out to be incredibly sensitive to climate change. The eelgrass has an upper temperature tolerance that's quite sensitive. And so the eelgrass communities in the Chesapeake Bay have been moving steadily northward year after year. And the kinds of changes we're talking about are not just restricted to the temperate zone or the boreal zone. We're also seeing changes in the tropics. But there, the changes are very often less about temperature than about moisture. So we're looking here at the legendary cloud forest of Monteverde in Costa Rica. And what's happening to the Monteverde cloud forest is that clouds are now forming more frequently at higher altitudes than previously, which means that the cloud forest is experiencing an increasing number of dry days. And that is of deadly consequence to cloud forests because they depend essentially 98% on condensation from clouds as the source of their moisture. We're also seeing what are called decoupling events, when two tightly linked features in nature turn out to use different methods of tracking conditions, one using temperature and the other using day length. And an interesting example of this is the snowshoe hare, which is very tightly tied to day length in changing from white winter pelage to something that will disguise it in a snowless environment. And of course, if there isn't any snow, but the snowshoe hare is sitting there bright and white in the middle of green or brown habitat, it's going to suffer much more frequent predation. Another interesting example involves this seabird, the black guillemot, which nests among other places, on the northern coast of Alaska. And there it flies to the edge of the Arctic ice to feed on Arctic cod. And cod, basically, the Arctic cod basically hangs out at the edge of the ice or just underneath it. And so, obviously, the black guillemots have been having to fly farther and farther every summer to get the Arctic cod to feed themselves and to feed their nestlings. And so there already have been some failures of nesting colonies of the black guillemot. So this slide, which I would severely mark down any student if they produced it because it's illegible, is actually to make the point that what I've been talking about now are not just isolated anecdotes and examples here and there. It is statistically robust to say you can see the fingerprints of climate change in nature almost everywhere you look around the world. So what we've been talking about so far are really relatively minor ripples in the fabric of life. The real question, the important question, is what might it look like going forward? So one of the things one can do is look at the climatic conditions under which a particular species or community occurs today, and then look at where those conditions are likely to exist in the future with, say, double pre-industrial levels of climate change. So if you do that for sugar maple, it turns out that whatever you value sugar maple for, whether it's maple syrup or maple sugar or autumn foliage, if we get to double pre-industrial levels of CO2, all the major computer models say if you want to enjoy those, you will have to go to Canada. And this image is actually to make the point that in terrestrial environments and for terrestrial organisms, the two most important physical factors are temperature and moisture. And the two most important factors in aquatic environments are temperature and pH, or acidity. And all of those are changing. Species which are adapted to cold waters, cold fresh waters like trout, will clearly be endangered by all of this. And any organism that lives in a high place, like the American pika, marvelous little animal that lives in series of colonies, mostly in the middle to the southern Rockies. Basically, what an animal like this one will be doing in response to climate change is simply moving upslope, trying to track its required climatic conditions. But of course, at some point, there is no further up to go. So species in high places as a category are some of the first that will be suffering badly from climate change. And this shows species richness of vertebrates in Australia responding to increases in temperature. And again, there comes a time when there is no further up for them to go. Sea level rise, of course, is going to be a serious issue. It's already manifesting itself. Some species will suffer from this more than others. We look at sea level rise and what it might mean for the Everglades National Park, for example. The likelihood of saltwater intrusion with this essentially low-lying ecosystem fed by a sheet flow of water, there's going to be a major shift in species which will be living there. And So it's sort of diagrammed here, a nice National Geographic diagram. But an interesting example will be the American alligator, which will probably get edged out competitively by the American crocodile, since the latter is able to excrete salt, which will give it an advantage. Species on islands, low-lying islands in particular, like the key deer, of course, will be very vulnerable to sea level rise. But all species on islands, actually, will be vulnerable. On the islands which have some altitude, species will literally be moving upward, just like the high mountain kinds of species, and ultimately run out of any place to go, and they have no lateral movement possible. So island species, species in high places, and those with biologies very tightly tied to ice, which of course the polar bear is the poster child, are three categories of species that will be first and foremost affected. But looking ahead, there are going to be a series of complications. And I'm going to go through these. And basically what I'm trying to build here is an argument that most of the things that we've been talking about up to this point are things one can countermanage against to some degree. But when you get to the major complications, the management challenge is much, much greater. And therefore, I will argue that we shouldn't be going that far. So one complication is what humans have done to landscapes almost everywhere they live in the world. And we know that glaciers advanced and retreated in these landscapes without much apparent loss of biological diversity. Species were able to track their required conditions. But of course today most landscapes have been through a process like this one, from continuous forest in this Wisconsin township in 1831 in the upper left, to series of isolated fragments of habitat in the lower right. And basically that creates an obstacle course for species which are trying to track their required conditions. As Michael Robinson, the former director of the National Zoo, once said, well, the species would move, but Philadelphia will be in the way. This one actually is something that it's pretty easy to do something about just by putting natural connections back into the landscape. And sometimes there are really important reasons to be doing that beyond putting natural connections back in the landscape. Think of natural vegetation along waterways and what it does to prevent soil erosion and enhance water quality. When you do that, it puts enormous amounts of connection back in the landscape. So this one is something we could actually take on if we decide to. But the next one is much more complex. And basically we know from what happened with the advance and retreat of the glaciers is that it's not ecosystems that move as a unit. It's the individual species that move, each in their own direction and at their own pace. And what that means is when you have a lot of change going on, a lot of climate change going on, that basically the species that constitute ecosystems will basically each move in their own direction at their own rate. And so therefore, ecosystems that we know will disassemble and the surviving species will reassemble into ecosystems which are really hard to imagine in advance, let alone figure out how to manage. So what we're looking at here is what happened after the retreat of the last glacier in Europe. And we're looking at three mammal species, two tree species, and an insect species. And you can see that there's not a lot of common pattern there. So again, building an argument to try and avoid a management challenge that's as complex as this would be. We also know that despite our computer models, which are largely linear and gradual, that we actually know the climate doesn't work that way. We just don't know where the surprises are as we look ahead. And this is the global conveyor belt, which moves warmth around the globe from the Pacific and Indian Ocean up to a point between Greenland and Europe, and then cools and sinks and goes back and starts the loop again. That's actually been known to shut down in geologic time. I'm not going to speculate as to whether we're seeing any flickerings of that at the moment or not. But regardless of the abrupt changes we're seeing possibly ahead in the climate system, we are already seeing abrupt changes in ecosystems. And prime amongst them is what's been happening to the coniferous forests in North America, where basically the longer summers and the milder winters have tipped the balance in favor of native bark beetles. So this will give you the sequence of the beetle outbreak in British Columbia from 1962 until early in this century. And at the outset, you can almost not even make out the little pinpricks of red, which are the outbreaks. But as the years pass by and the climate warms and the winters become milder and the summers longer, the impact is greater. And even after a harsh winter, as occurred in 1985, it doesn't knock it back as far as it did before. So basically, there are whole stretches of coniferous forests from southern Alaska to southern Colorado with enormous percentages of the trees dead because of this. And I don't think anybody really knows what those forests are going to turn out to be like in the end. Another highly dramatic abrupt change in ecosystems involves tropical coral reefs, which pretty much look like this when I was a graduate student. These just marvelous technicolor, highly productive, highly diverse communities of vital importance to the 5% of humanity which lives within 100 meters of tropical coral reefs. And it turns out that these are very sensitive to climate change, let alone the acidification of the oceans, which I'll touch on later. So this entire ecosystem depends on a partnership between the coral animal and an alga. And not very much warming for not very long period of time will cause the coral animal simply to eject the alga, and then the entire system crashes, and you get what are known as bleaching events. There's extensive bleaching at the moment, for example, on the Great Barrier Reef. So the diversity crashes, the productivity crashes, the benefit to local communities crash, and this is happening with increasing frequency around the world, and the capacity of these systems to bounce back after these events seems to be wearing a bit thin. So the point I'm trying to make here with this example and the coniferous forest example is that you can do all the climate modeling you want, and you can do all the vegetation modeling you want, but it's never going to pick up the sensitivities that exist because of relations between just a couple species which make entire systems vulnerable. So anything you get from climate modeling, vegetation modeling, is basically going to underestimate the impacts that are likely to come. And then we're seeing changes which are even at a greater scale, which I call system change. And one of these involves one of my favorite places in the world, namely the Amazon. So this is a just a marvelous model, hour by hour, of the generation and movement of moisture around the globe, mostly over the equator and mostly over the oceans. I won't take you through the entire 365 days, hour by hour. But I draw your attention to the far right, where you see moisture coming off the tropical Atlantic and entering the Amazon, and there it actually is recycled, drops as rain, evaporates off the complex surfaces of the forest, is exhaled, transpired through the leaves, recycles five or six times. Once we knew that that was the case, the question was always, you know, how much deforestation would it take to cause that to unravel? And some of the early climate models actually suggested there would be Amazon dieback in the southern and eastern Amazon. The more recent ones are less strong about that. But the combination of deforestation and whatever climate change is going on, even a suggestion that the leaves are transpiring less in a recent paper, cause one to be concerned that a big chunk of the world's ecology and biology is very vulnerable. And so I think the Amazon, in fact, is very close to a tipping point. It can be addressed by doing some reforestation, building back a safety margin from the 20% deforestation that currently is the state. But we've had these major droughts in 2005 and 2010 without any precedence in any recorded history, suggesting that these might be the first flickers of major system change in the Amazon. And of course, should that happen, there's a tremendous amount of biodiversity that would be lost, tremendous impact on the people who depend on the Amazon and its biodiversity, and a huge pulse of carbon added to the already growing amount in the atmosphere. So another major system change, and one that basically was below the radar until about 2005, is as the oceans absorb some of the excess CO2 we put in the atmosphere, a fraction of it has actually converted to carbonic acid and made the oceans more acid. So the oceans today are a tenth of a pH unit more acid than in pre-industrial times. But because this is a logarithmic scale, that's actually 30% more acid. So why should we worry about that? I mean, it's basically ocean basins wide. It's because there are tens of thousands of species which depend on a carbonate equilibrium to build their skeletons or their shells. Important for corals, important for giant clams, important for a lot of organisms that we know about, and also important for tiny little organisms, like this sea butterfly or pteropod, which is actually a tiny little snail. It's like that big, right? And instead of moving along on a foot like a snail normally does, this foot is modified so they can flap like little wings and maintain the tiny little sea butterfly in the water column. And they exist in untold numbers in the North Atlantic, off of Alaska, at the base of the marine food chain, and they're quite sensitive to ocean acidification. So this is to sort of look ahead for what acidification itself might mean for tropical coral reefs, regardless of the temperature. So at 380, it's already become pretty inhospitable. We're already at 400 parts per million, 450. Not a great future for tropical coral reefs if we keep going the way we're going. And so that would be at double pre-industrial levels. Not a good future for tropical coral reefs. So what I'm trying to build here is an argument that we really need to take the extent of climate change more seriously than we have been, that we shouldn't be thinking of a CO2 target of 450 parts per million. We shouldn't be settling for 2 degrees of climate change, which was why the Paris conference was so refreshing to see 1.5 degrees emerge once again. So there are all kinds of reasons dealing with ice to think that 2 degrees is too much, and clearly major ecosystem disruption is in the cards and a major argument. So for normal audiences I give this to, when I get to this slide, I said, you know, if there's one fact I want you to take away from this, it's the following, which is that the last time the oceans was 2 degrees warmer, the Earth was, we know sea level was 4 to 6 meters higher. So we know the endpoint. We just don't know how fast it would come. So the rest of this talk will be about thinking about how we could actually avoid ending up with a 2 degree centigrade Celsius amount of climate change. And basically, it all is going to revolve in the end about around how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere. So Jim Hansen was probably the first to start to argue that we should try and limit ourselves to 350 parts per million, remembering again that pre-industrial was 280. And of course, we're already at 400, so is it all over? So this is Dr. Planet, and he's made the diagnosis, and now he's going to make some prescriptions. Some will be about conservation strategies, and some will be about greenhouse gas concentrations. So for revising conservation strategies, protecting the biology that we have, some of that's pretty obvious. We already touched on natural connectivity, increasing that in the continents of the world. But then there's also things that can be done by just minimizing other kinds of stress, avoiding negative synergies. And, you know, an interesting example that will work with relatively minor amounts of sea level rise is actually restoring the plumbing of South Florida with the freshwater flow, which, among other things, will create stronger wetland buffering against storm surge. And there's a huge energy agenda. I don't pretend to be deeply expert about the energy agenda, except to say we need to take this deeply seriously, in contrast to what went on at 1600 Pennsylvania today. But there is a piece of this that most of the world is unaware of, a lot of you are acutely aware of, which is that what we do to modern-day ecosystems actually is a major contributor to climate change. And on an annual basis, the gross percentage of emissions that come from deforestation is actually something on the order of 30% of the total. You rarely see that given you. What you usually see is the net figure, the balance of reforestation against deforestation. But it's a really big number. And obviously, there are lots of reasons to want to do something about that anyway. So this is the annual equation we have to play with. About 5 times as much as carbon going to the atmosphere from fossil fuels is from deforestation and ecosystem destruction, and about half ending up in the atmosphere and the rest evenly divided between the land and the oceans. So the question is, can we change some of these numbers? Could we maybe even change the direction of one of these arrows? And one of the reasons that there's real value in doing this is that greenhouse gases stay in the atmosphere a very long time. But they also don't immediately trap the radiant heat that a particular greenhouse gas level would ultimately accumulate. That doesn't happen immediately. It happens over time. So if there are ways to pull the CO2 level down below where it is now, you could actually avoid climate change before the radiant heat is trapped. So that's the part I really want to leave you with. I call it a wild idea, a wild solution for climate change, which is actually looking at what restoring ecosystems can do to help us with this huge challenge. And we need to do that. It won't be enough. So we'll need to figure out other ways to pull CO2 out of the atmosphere that are not biological. And the interesting thing is, if you look at the history of life on Earth and the history of climate and atmospheric composition, there were two periods when there were just unbelievably high levels of CO2 in the atmosphere that were then brought down to pre-industrial levels by natural processes. In other words, the planet is capable of fixing this. But what we don't have is the time of tens of millions of years that it would take if we just let it take its normal course. So the first time this happened, it coincided with the origin of plants on land and all that photosynthesis. Second time with the arrival of modern flowering plants doing all of that more efficiently. But there was also a really important soil element in all of this, not just the physical formation of soil, but the biological formation of soil. So basically, it was a biodiversity symphony working in this direction in both cases. So there is a significant amount of excess CO2 in the atmosphere from centuries of destruction and degradation of ecosystems. I don't know what the current thought is about the number now, but when I put that slide together, it was in the range of 200 and 250 billion tons of carbon. It's a lot of carbon. And the Woods Hole Research Center has been working since its inception on the forest part of this puzzle, and is currently working on extending it beyond that, basically doing an ecosystem restoration map for the world. Not that it would say that every place that ends up being pointed to in this map will end up that way, but it will truly give us a sense of what we could actually do if we embrace the natural biology of the planet. So major piece of this, of course, will be how we manage forests, major amount of reforestation, benefit for watersheds. Another important piece will involve grasslands and grazing lands. And there's a huge amount of degraded grassland and grazing lands in the world. And what do you get if you restore them? You get better grazing. So many of these things we should be thinking about doing in any case as we face a future with billions of more people who will need to have a reasonable quality of life. And I think another major piece of this will be agroecosystems, so many of which today actually leak carbon the way they're managed, but can be managed in ways that actually increase carbon. And when that happens, soil fertility increases. Again, something worth doing in its own right. And more recently, in the last 5, 6, 7 years, there's been an additional element added to this list, which is what you can do with coastal wetlands, whether they're mangroves in the tropics or marshlands in this part of the world, there's a lot of carbon that can be sequestered by restoring coastal wetlands, so-called blue carbon. So we're doing all of this, of course, at a time of increasing human population, increasing demands on the environment. But actually, people who've looked at that challenge have determined we can actually feed people adequately. All the billions coming without destroying another square inch of nature, just through better intensification of agriculture, minimizing food waste, which is on the order of 30% of all food is wasted, and changing diets, which our doctors have been telling us to do anyway. So that is what I call the wild solution to climate change. Regreening the emerald planet, making the planet more habitable for humans and other forms of life. Thank you very much.
Tom, what I want to focus on is the challenge for conservation strategies. So it has multiple purposes. Right, obviously to preserve the biological heritage of the planet, but also to provide a whole host of services that people depend on, particularly perhaps in the developing world, although not only there. And yet, the strategies that people have employed have this tendency to come undone in a world where the climate system, physical climate system, is changing underneath them. Right, so how do we think about new strategies that build some resiliency into the in the face of a climate system that's really changing quite rapidly?
Well, that's a very important and central question, really, to the future of the planet and humanity. Mm-hmm. And I think basically we haven't been thinking big enough that. One of the reasons I like the ecosystem restoration is that I'm not going to say if, but when the time comes that it's embraced, it will mean that people are beginning to understand that our planet actually does not work just as a physical system, but as a linked physical and biological system. And I think the minute that realization arrives, it's a more respectful sort of outlook. I also like it because it takes climate change from being this enormous, what can I possibly do kind of thing, to something that everybody can do something about, planting a tree or helping restore a wetland, just like victory gardens in the Second World War. Mm-hmm. So having said that, I think the kinds of discussions that are going on now, led by Ed Wilson in particular, with Half Earth, are precisely in the right direction. And we need a planet that functions biologically. We need a planet in which human aspiration is more sensitive to the biological underpinnings. And we need to start thinking really at a big scale, so that there are connections and landscapes, which are probably the most important thing you can do to protect against climate change.
So I have a sort of a follow-on question from that. And you've worked both in institutions, you know, here in the U.S., but also you have this long and deep experience in Brazil and in other places in the developing world. Are these concepts that are easier to grasp there rather than here, or vice versa? Are we
particularly wrestling
with
moment,
ourselves?
Right?
Yeah, right.
So one of the really interesting moments
as an aberration.
So what's so interesting about Brazil, which on the one hand you would think has just totally embraced the American model and, you know, it's plowing over everything. that's only one part of what goes on in Brazil. And so Brazil is the country in the world that has the highest percentage recognition of the word biodiversity, which is a big surprise. But I think it's because the Earth Summit was there, mm-hmm. and it dominated the news, you know, long before and long after. And although, you know, all you read about half the time, more than half the time, is the bad news and, you know, this deforestation problem or whatever, Brazil is actually, as far as the Amazon is concerned, indeed, all the Amazon countries have already done half Earth without anybody quite noticing, right? So there was one national park in the entire Amazon when I set foot in it in 1965, and now more than half of it is either demarcated indigenous reserves or other kinds of protection. So in addition, there is a really interesting aspect of the way government works in Brazil, which is the ministries tend to largely be technologically driven. And so there's less of a jolting difference from one administration to the next.
Mm-hmm. Let's thank our speaker.
Thank you.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Professor Thomas Lovejoy, Senior Fellow at the United Nations Foundation. Professor Lovejoy's lecture was titled Biology and Climate Change and was presented by the Boston University Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. Tonight's moderator was Pardee Center Director, Professor Anthony Genetos. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jeff Turton and Edward Mazulis. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotis. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Thanks for joining us. We'll be right back.